Resources Department, Beverly Callender Anderson. And the Black History Month Planning Committee, I'd like to welcome you all to the 2018 State of the Black Community. This evening, we are joined by City Clerk Nicole Bolden and members of the Bloomington City Council. Let's give them a round of applause. The City of Bloomington Black History Month Planning Committee is able to host this event because of sponsors and the invaluable partners who are committed to supporting National Black History Month. Please join me in thanking our sponsors. At the Platinum Plus level, we have the City of Bloomington, Office of the Mayor, the Indiana Civil Rights Commission, IU Office for the Vice President for Diversity, Equity, and Multicultural Affairs, Lumina Foundation. At the Platinum level, we have the City of Bloomington, Community and Family Resources Department, and Old National Bank. The Gold level, we have Ivy Tech Community College, and the Sidney and Lois Eskenazi Museum of Art, Indiana University. Our Silver level sponsors, the Monroe County Branch NAACP, and Dr. K. Luke Eads, DDS. A special thanks to the Business Research Center, the Kelly School of Business, the Bloomington Housing Authority, Indiana University, the Indiana University Police Department, the Monroe County Government, Little G's Lemonade, Donald Griffin, the City of Bloomington Government, and the Bloomington Police Department. Again, a round of applause for our sponsors and supporters. I'd also like to recognize the support and assistance from the Bloomington Black Strategic Alliance and the NAACP. Thank you so much for your support in hosting this first annual State of the Black Community. So why State of the Black Community? On an evening when former First Lady Michelle Obama is speaking in Indianapolis. Why? According to the 2010 census, there are about 80,000 people living in Bloomington. 5% of those people are African American. There's a great value on datum, and there's a great value in having people that represent our community speak to our community. I say this because this is a time when people often lay claims to having to being responsible for the highest unemployment rate for African Americans in this country. It was Amilcar Cabral that said every responsible member must have the courage and responsibility, exacting from others a proper respect for work and properly respecting the work of the others. Hide nothing from the masses of the people, he said. Tell no lies, expose lies whenever they're told. Mask no difficulties or mistakes. Claim no easy victories. Before we begin with tonight's program, I'd like to issue a few reminders. Please silence your mobile devices, as well as making sure that you do not have food or drink with you inside council chambers. Lastly, we'd like to invite you to evaluate us. Tell us how we're doing. After the program is over, members of the Black History Month Planning Committee and other volunteers will be standing by with evaluation forms. Your input is greatly needed. And at this time, I'd like to welcome the president of the Monroe County Black Democratic Caucus, Mr. William Hosea. Let's have a round of applause.
This one goes forward?
Yes, sir.
Thank you so much. Greetings, everyone. Thank you for being here. You all must really care about your community tonight because you're here. I just got to get this out front. Where's the mayor at? Okay. It was not my intent to preempt your State of the City address on Thursday. But Rafi Hassan gave me a date and I ran with it. So now that Rafi's under the bus. Now, we started this over a year ago because we wanted to know the state of our community. We wanted to know what condition it was in compared to some of the other ethnic groups in Monroe County. So what exactly is a state of the community address? It's a tool that we can use to measure progress and track racial equality in areas like economics, education, and criminal justice in Monroe County. Now, to help you understand it a little bit more, the National Urban League publishes a State of Black America report every year. They've been doing this for the past 41 years. And they cover a lot of the topics that we're going to be talking about tonight, except that they also cover health and civic participation. They also rank about 70 metropolitan areas based on unemployment and income inequality for both blacks and Hispanics. Now, Monroe County didn't make the cut for those 70 metropolitan areas, so we're going to try and do it tonight. So before we actually get started, I got to say that some of the information, some of the data that you're going to be hearing tonight might be a little bit unsettling. It kind of raised my eyebrows when I saw it. But just keep in mind, it is in no way intended to disparage any one person or organization. So we're going to start off talking about economics, which includes employment and housing. The data that we're discussing tonight includes four different ethnic groups: whites, blacks, Asians, and Hispanics. And if I start going through these slides a little bit too fast, just raise your hand. Or if you're done looking at them, look up this way and I'll know to go to the next slide. So looking at the population of Monroe County, right around 145,500. And of that number, 5,200 people make up the black community, which is about 3.6%. And again, I'm talking about Monroe County. And that number does include university students. So keep that 3.6% in mind as we go through the rest of these slides, because in a perfect world, we would also make up 3.6% of the workforce, or 3.6% of our elected officials. We should own that 3.6% of the homes in Monroe County. So we're going to find out if that's true or not. If you put it in a chart, this is what it looks like. The overall projected unemployment rate, 6.2%. Now, I know what some of you are thinking. The actual unemployment rate in Monroe County is 3.2%, about 3 percentage points lower than what you see here. Now, the reason that I have the projected rate is because we get this information from the Census Bureau, but they only put it out every 10 years. So when you start talking about smaller geographic locations and smaller populations, they don't go into this level of detail every single year. So what they do is they put out 5-year estimates. And this data was estimated for 2017, which means it was based on 2012 numbers. And so the unemployment rate in 2012 was a little bit different than what it is now. So looking at this, I kind of had a math moment. I wanted to try and figure out exactly what the current unemployment rates are. So I called Matt over at the Business Research Center, the Kelly School of Business. I said, Matt, since the actual rate for the county is exactly 3 percentage points below this rate, what if I just take 3 points off of all of those and that'll give me my rate? So he thought about it for a minute. He said, no, McFly, that's not going to work. So what you have to do is kind of disregard the numbers and just look at the columns in the chart. Because even if we had the actual unemployment rates, that chart would look just about the same. It would not be very much of a difference. And notice that African Americans, the unemployment rate is about twice that for what it is for for whites and Hispanics. So we were able to collect some data from some of the local employers. As you can see, Indiana University tops the list, followed by MCCSC, City of Bloomington, and Monroe County, less than 1,000, and then the two police departments are less than 100. I'll leave that up just for a moment, because there's quite a few numbers up there. When you're ready for me to go, just look up this way. Okay, everybody's looking up this way. So I took all of those and I put those in charts as well. Now, going from one chart to the next, you can see there's not a whole lot of fluctuation in the percentages of the workforce from one organization to the next. And I also broke out the two police departments. Now, the numbers for the Bloomington Police Department are included in the numbers that the city provided. And the same thing for the IU Police Department. Their numbers are included in the university's numbers. But I broke those out separately anyway, just to give you another graphic representation of what it looks like from the smaller organizations. Let me back up one. Now, so that was six employers that we were able to get employment data from. And when you add all of those together, it comes to about 12,500 people. We make up about 3.2% of the workforce just from those six organizations, which is not too bad considering we're 3.6% of the population. And in case you're wondering, yes, I did request data from Cook Pharmaceuticals. They declined the data, but they did give me a nice long paragraph about how they support diversity. So we had a little miscommunications with the Sheriff's Department. I think I just didn't get the email, but I found out later he sent them to me. So maybe we can get that information in there next time around. So moving on to the housing information. Four categories: privately owned homes. And when I say that, I mean owner-occupied homes. So for someone who has like 10 or 15 homes, we're only counting the home that they actually live in. TAD stands for the American Dream. And then we have data on rentals, public housing, and the Housing Choice Voucher Program, which you probably know as Section 8. So let's take a look at privately owned homes. Almost 30,000 in Monroe County. And for the black community, we own about 412 of those homes, 1.4%. Rental homes, almost 25,000, and we occupy roughly 1,100 of those, and that number goes up a little bit to 4.7%. And then we get into public housing units. Not a lot of those. Out of 404, we occupy 59, but notice how the percentage goes up to 15. And then when we look at the Housing Choice Voucher or Section 8, 1,500, we occupy roughly 300, and the percentages rise again, 20%. Of Section 8 housing. So what I did at that point, I took all four of those and I put them side by side. And I looked at them, and those four charts tell a story. So if you start from owner-occupied home, start from the American Dream, move to rentals, move to public housing, and move to Housing Choice Voucher, the percentage goes up each time. The farther we move away from privately owned homes, the greater the percentage. You can look at it in reverse also. Starting at Section 8, the closer you get to privately owned homes, the lower the percentage. And that's not good, because in greater America, for African Americans, the majority of our wealth is concentrated in our homes. We don't own as much real estate We don't own as many businesses. We don't own as much stock. So if we don't own a whole lot of homes, there's not a lot of wealth in our community. I hope I've given you something to think about. As that concludes my portion of the presentation, so I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Mr. Jeff Bradley so he can talk about the criminal justice system. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone.
All right.
I'm going to use the wireless, which is naturally a lot easier for me. Do we get it on?
No.
I walk around and talk, do my day job, so it's a lot easier for me to do it this way than say it. Okay. Okay. I'll still make it work.
Okay. All right. So they've asked me to talk about the criminal justice aspect. And really, to give it its due, we would be here for hours to go through the statistical information and the things they want to talk about. So what they've asked me to cover would be a small snapshot. So we're going to look at just two time periods of information that we want to talk about and really deal with what would be called the pretrial release aspects of people in detention. So while there's a lot of other areas that are important in the criminal justice system, they would like us to really focus on these right now. So, and with that, I want to do a little background for everyone here. For those of you who might have been aware, back in February of 2001, the Monroe County NAACP and the What Color is Community Task Force for the Unitarian Universalist Church did a study and a report as to the status of individuals incarcerated. From that meeting and that task force discussion, they thought it needs to get bigger and there should be some more information culled and people looking into more information here. So what they did was then in March, there was a Monroe County Racial Justice Task Force that was convened. And again, their focus is to look at racial disparity within the Monroe County judicial system. And they covered a lot of areas, and they completed a 61-page report about a lot of different topics. But again, we want to talk about one of the aspects they got into on that date, which had to do with the pretrial release aspect. So they took 1 year in this report. It was the year of 2000. And Indiana University assisted, and they did data collection and did some local studies and tried to make some determinations as to some information as to what do we have and what are we looking at and what are we dealing with. So, and then it made some recommendations as well to the county. So that's what we're looking at. They were looking at a year 2000 and then this one small snapshot. So, and you'll see that we'll correct it here in a second, but from their research and their work, they found they were looking at misdemeanors and felony offenses. I know it says federal, but we're going to be talking about felony, okay? So what they were looking at had to do with the average time in jail for a person in a pretrial detention situation. And for misdemeanors, their study came with a 7.7 days for black defendants, 2.8 days for white defendants. And then they had another data set for felony offenses, which would be the 40 and the 24.6. So clearly when the task force completed their study, that was an area of concern, and that was an area that they wanted at least for people to focus on and be aware of and look at. And so that was a trend that led to some follow-up information, some follow-up discussion. And again, if I go too fast, if I'm covering something, just let me know and we'll stop. In 2017, Guy Laufman, who's a local attorney here in town, who's been involved in the task force previously, he approached the Monroe County Circuit Court Board of Judges, the criminal division, again working with the Unitarian Church and the Monroe County NAACP, under the auspices to collect additional data and get some more information, because clearly they did a study in 2000 and we're 17, 18 years later, where are we? what things are going on, what things are we looking at, what are our trends. So the Board of Judges was very helpful and open to provide information for the newest task force to start looking at some information. And so what they were dealing with, and the participating organizations are on the screen, but as you can tell, there's a lot of organizations within our community that were interested in this type of study and interested in what type of information that could be gleaned from it. So they were supportive, and Mr. Loftman would have been the point person to make some of these contacts and talk to folks. So we had the data requested. He requested back in October of 2017. And again, there's a snapshot. So what they're going to do is look at a snapshot from 2016 to 2017, about a one-year period of information regarding data in the jails. So what this study said, again, is from November 1st to October 25th, and what they're looking at is what is the average length of stay for an individual who is on pretrial detention. And so in this data study, when they're looking at the average length of stay, they were finding 11 day for defendants who are identified as black, and a 13 day for individuals who are identified as white. Now, again, the group was, that was a positive difference from what they were looking at in the year 2000, but it was just the start of information that's gonna be looked at and collected. This is, again, with both data sets, and as everybody knows with statistics, there's a lot more that you can look at and a lot more that you can cull. But the focus here is they really wanted to know is what are our trends and what do we have going on here in Monroe County? And one of the things that the group also noticed or noted was a positive aspect had to deal with the sentencing patterns. And they were finding no noticeable difference in sentencing patterns for a black defendant versus a white defendant in some of their data studies. So that was a positive in there. So again, this is just a graphic detailing what we're just talking about. Now, the other aspect I want to talk about or touch on would be what's happened in 2016 and has some aspect with this data information. For those of you who may or may not be aware, the Indiana Supreme Court promulgated a new rule back in 2016 where they wanted the counties to start working on and exploring pretrial release programs and doing studies on the same. There were 11 counties who were identified, not initially, and in a total of 11 currently, that are part of the pilot program. So they're doing what's called a pretrial release programming. So what does that mean? Because everybody's just like, what are we talking about here? So the focus is, and I'll just read it to you for what Criminal Rule 26 is talking about from the Indiana Supreme Court. If an arrestee does not present a substantial risk of flight or a danger to themselves or others, the court shall release the arrestee without monetary bail or surety subject to such restrictions and conditions as may be determined by the court. And then there's some specific exceptions for certain types of crimes and certain type of individuals. But what is going on starting in 2016 is Monroe County volunteered to be one of the pilot program counties. And this expectation of every county of Indiana should have a pretrial release program by 2020. And so what their focus is, and probably as everybody can assume, is in situations where you're talking about primarily low to moderate risk offenders, as well as some other high risk offenders, you want to have them assessed. What's going on with their situation, looking at different data points, and you're doing evidence-based practices. And the question is this an individual that under certain restrictions can be released from the Monroe County Jail? What are the restrictions? And really, will they ensure that they will appear at court? And will they be not appear as a danger to themselves and to the community? And so that's what we're going on with the pretrial release aspect. And it's something that Monroe County has been active in and has been doing since the fall of 2016. So when we start looking at data, and that's why when I was talking at the beginning, when we start talking about this data, we could be here for hours. Because we've got different years and different changes that have occurred that are gonna have an impact on how we see the snapshot. But what we wanted to at least look at was this information. And so right now we have a lot of partners in our community, particularly Indiana University, I believe Ivy Tech, that are willing to be involved in helping with this data, collating this data, identifying what we have. And then also our court system, our board of judges are going to be working with what are best practices and what ways can we utilize our bond system, our pretrial release system, and other programs so that we're not dealing with a scenario to where a person is just sitting in jail waiting for the resolution of their case. And so, again, it's early on, and with the data that's been collected, there's still more to get, okay? We're not done. Obviously, they're not done working on data. They're not done reviewing it and making some determinations and making some recommendations and suggestions. But what, you know, right now is what they've asked me to talk about is with this criminal justice aspect and what we have is we're hoping to see a positive trend toward looking at the numbers when we're talking about pretrial release, how many days a person is spending in jail. And I think the goal, and there's several defense attorneys in here who can probably agree that if the issue is just monetary bond, is that the reason that they're still in jail, that's really not a productive aspect. And there's a great deal of information about the negative results of a person remaining in jail for an extended period of time. So I think the court is trying to be proactive, and the Indiana Supreme Court is trying to be proactive in dealing with that. But like I said, it's the concern is always going to be when we're looking at our community, we want to do the best we can. And so these numbers aren't stellar, obviously. You know, you never want to see a situation where the numbers aren't consistent across the board for folks, especially given, as William was talking about, our percentage of within our community. But we want to keep working toward a positive direction, and I think there's a lot of folks here that want to be partners in that to, if we're going to be a pilot program, we're going to be a good program. So we're going to do that. But with this, I think, you know, with the information that's been provided thus far, we don't know if there's a cause and effect relationship between the pretrial release program and our numbers. We're looking at our data points of the year 2000 and the year 2016. So there's other data points we're going to have to review and consider. But again, I think this is a good snapshot to see that folks, Monroe County NAACP and the Unitarian Task Force, the church, and other interested parties in our community were involved, that people were reacting to it and trying to do some things in a positive direction. So that's what I have thus far for us on the criminal justice aspect. I appreciate everybody's attention, and thank you very much.
Stephanie Power Carter, and I am here to present on education. And I decided I would start with a quote by Marian Edelman Wright. Education remains one of the Black community's most enduring values. It is sustained by the belief that freedom and education go hand in hand, that learning and training are essential to economic quality and interdependence. And so when I think about education, it says something about freedom and about economics. So all of the stuff that we've already talked about is really related to education. And it's something that I'm very, very passionate about. People who know me know that. And I want to say, while some of the data that I'm sharing today, I decided to share ISTEP data and some discipline data. As William says, quite sobering. It's disturbing a bit, but I want to make sure that in talking about some of the challenges Black students have in this district, that we honor their resilience, that we don't think about them in pathological or negative ways, but we look at them, I mean, they have, in spite of all of the challenges they face, they persevere, and I think that is amazing. And so I want to make sure that I honor that, and also want to make sure that I honor the amazing educators, because I'm an educator, who go to school every day in spite of the challenges that they face to support those kids. So I want to acknowledge that, even though some of the data is quite interesting that I share that. I also want to say that I have two people who will be joining me in this presentation. Caleb Poor is one of them, and Bella, and I'm glad to have them here today because we can't talk about kids without engaging them in the conversation, right, or young people. So Caleb is going to come and talk about something that is really related to education these days. It's the school-to-prison pipeline. He's going to share some information about that, and then I'll come back up. But I would like for Caleb Poor, who is a senior at North High School and IU bound, I'm glad to say, I'll have him come up now. Thanks, Caleb.
Hope you guys are doing good today. Thank you to Mr. Jose for allowing me to present today. I'll be talking about the school-to-prison pipeline, and more so the prison aspect and how we got here as a country and sort of the background around that. But the school-to-prison pipeline is defined as the disproportionate tendency of minors and young adults that are disadvantaged to become incarcerated, primarily due to harsh school policies. This began in the 1970s, actually, and we experienced a huge spike in incarceration rates. This was the result of Nixon, actually, President Nixon and the war on drugs. The incarceration rate per 100,000 people in 1970 was roughly 2,000, and since in 2010, or 200, my bad, but in 2010, that number rose to 930. And we've experienced a 500% increase in prison populations over the last 40 years. So on June 18th, President Nixon gave a press conference in which he declared that the war on drugs was the number one public enemy. Sorry, getting a little lost here. But, 1 second, I'm having some troubles here with this. Okay. So, in a 1994 interview, a White House aide under Nixon said that the Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House thereafter had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. By getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. So the war on drugs was really like this public enemy number one was sort of a front to disenfranchise these communities. And one of the effects of the Nixon administration was the stark difference in drug sentencing. And so as a result of that, we have like crack cocaine, for example, which is, as we know, penalized much, much harsher than powder cocaine. Now being caught with 1 gram of crack cocaine would get you the same sentence as being caught with 18 grams of powder cocaine. And crack cocaine is much more potent and much more prevalent in poorer communities, which is where you would find a lot of minorities and disadvantaged people. Now, his presidency, of course, was riddled with the Watergate scandal, and he resigned in 1974, but the precedent had been set. And every year since, more and more people have been arrested for drug-related offenses. In 1980, about 41,000 people were incarcerated for drug crimes, but in 2014, that number has risen to 488,000, which is a 1,000% increase. And so it is obviously a well-established fact that minorities are overrepresented in prison population. About 58% of all sentenced inmates in 2013 were black or Hispanic, despite the two groups only making up 30% of our overall population. And so that is when we saw corporations start to make money off of these people. In 1983, which would have been around the Reagan era, a company was created called the Corrections Corporation of America, which is better known as the CCA, and they own and manage private prisons. And the way that they make money is by receiving stipends from the government. So they'll buy a prison from the government and say it costs $100 to take care of a prisoner for 1 day. The government would give them $150, so long as they can run the prison cheaper than what the federal government could. And so over the years, these corporations have become a billion-dollar industry, and they've used their influence to lobby candidates who will be tough on drugs, tough on crime, and ultimately make them more money. As we know, it is essentially political suicide to be considered weak on crime, so almost no politicians will advocate for these prisoners' rights, and soon after they realized that the best investment for them was not to target adults, but to target kids. And so by influencing these politicians, they've been able to change the way that our schools discipline students. And this is all seen much clearer when you look at the suspension and expulsion rates among schools, which Dr. Power Carter has some information on. Thank you for your time.
So I will try and hurry up. It's always hard to be last, right? All right. So trends in MCCS Bloomington. And can you click on that for me? So some of the data I have is from the Office of Civil Rights. Let's see if we can get it to open. And I'll be quick because I know you want to engage in conversation and I don't want to take up all of our time. Can you scroll down for me? So, all right. So what does this say? It says that black students make up 4.9% of the school, and that's this chart over here. And in school suspension, they make up 14.6%. So we already see that there's some challenges here. And we can see that in out-of-school suspensions, they make up 19.4%. So do you remember what I told you? What's the percentage of black students in the school? What? And so it makes up for in-school suspension, what is it? Out of school? Okay. And they 5% of expulsion. Nationally, black students are suspended or expelled 3 times more than their white counterparts. Trends begin in preschool. 18% are black, all suspended, and they're more than once, and 48% are black. So out of all of them, 18%, but then more than once, it's 48%. So you can, it's staggering, right? It's staggering. Another thing to note is that black students and other students get in trouble at similar rates, but one study found that black students are more likely to be steered from graduations because they receive harsher punishment. White students are more likely to be suspended for probable offenses like smoking or vandalism, and black students are more likely to be suspended because of talking back or insubordination. And so that is pretty much a national trend. And kids who are suspended or expelled are more likely to drop out. So, staggering, right? All right, so let's move to, and this is actually on the web. You can access this data anytime you want to. And this data is from 2013-14, and some new data will be coming up, and I'm sure that there is new data compiled. I just did not have access to it within the time frame that we were trying to get it, but it's this is right there. You can get this information, and if you scroll down the page, it breaks it down even among students who are in special education or who are being served in different ways, and so there are lots of charts, but due to time, I won't go through all of them, but definitely look at those. Okay, let me see. Can I move to the next slide? Okay, so there's this really interesting new trend in schools. Black girls are 6 times more likely to be suspended And again, it's the same attitude, it's the same, and this is a new trend in Indiana, and I just thought I would show it to you. And if you can look, it's really young women of color, because Latina girls too, they're up there too. And it's disturbing. I'll keep going. So I-STEP. So let's look at the I-STEP data a little bit. So this is what? Grades 3 through 8. And one of the things that I noticed is if you look at English language arts, you'll see that in the purple is the state of Indiana. So you can see that in most columns, we're above the state average, which is interesting. But you can look, English language arts 3 through 8, 49%, math 41%. And I have some charts that show what that looks like, but you can kind of look at the trends. You see, in relation to other groups. And I'll have to say that we do not have people from indigenous groups on this chart. And it's because when you start looking at data, they become statistically insignificant because they're such a small percentage, but they matter too, okay? But we're looking at black students, and I just wanted to make sure that you saw that data. At the 10th grade level, 63% are passing English language arts, so that's interesting. And it looks like it's higher than the state average, which is like 30-something percent. 18.2% at math. Math is really low. And only 20% pass both math and English language arts. That's where our kids are. And again, it's challenging to look to see that only 18.2% pass the math. And I see some faces. I see some faces. But that is pretty much the reality here. And I think we have the graduation rates. You see the graduation rates. Actually, black graduation rate is a little bit below the green, if you see the green, than the state average. That's what the data is saying. So, how are we addressing the challenges? And like I said, I want to make sure that I give a balanced presentation because I think some people are aware of that. And so I want to say that MCCSC, these are some of the things that I'm aware of that they're doing. Starting maybe a year or so ago, they had a professional development that they did with Tyrone Howard. And last year they did one with Derek Green, and they work with the Equity Center. And I think they've been trying to better understand some of those challenges. Sort of a restructuring. They hired a diversity coordinator, and I think Mr. Hanks is here in the audience. They created assistant superintendent for curriculum position. That's something that I'm aware that they did. Also at the district, and some of those people are here, they started a diversity advisory board. Anybody from that board here? Raise your hand. Thank you. And then just recently, Dr. Marque Winston started an equity, access, and opportunity steering committee to start looking at curriculum. And at the school level, they developed last year, or started, I think it's in its infancy, some school cultural responsive teams, and I know that Mr. Hanks has been doing some community table talk series. So those are some of the things that, and I know that a lot of this work has to do with culture in understanding kids. I think it's really interesting that there was that black kids in the district were faring at the 10th grade level higher at English language arts. Black community, if you do a lot of research, is a very oral community. And so I'm not surprised in some ways that trend might be occurring. So it might be a way for us to begin thinking about how we teach math and how we teach other subjects if they're stronger in other areas. That might be something that people want to consider. Programs at local schools. I know that Bloomington North has something called the Movement Club, and it's been going on since the 90s. They have a civil rights club. They have Sisters Who Care for young women of color. Those have been going on for some time. I know Bloomington South has the South Black Culture Club, and then of course there's something we call the African American Read-In that the kids, you might have seen in the paper just recently. Those are programs, and those are for older kids. What I realized is there's not a ton for younger kids in the Bloomington community. However, there are programs in the Bloomington community that try to fill that gap from time to time. So you have the Bloomington Commission on the Status of Black Males, you have the local NAACP, you have Mothers and Allies for Anti-Racist Practices, which is MAP. You have Girls Inc., the Crimson Leadership Academy, which is something that is at Fairview and that targets young men of color. Actually, that's one of the few programs that specifically speak to that challenge. You have the Delta Academy, which is for young women, and that is by Delta Sigma Theta Sorority Incorporated. You have the Banneker Community Center, the Boys and Girls Club. Those are some of the community places that kind of serve kids. And I just wanted to make sure that I shared those as well. But when you look at the data, it is staggering. It is very staggering. Bella, come on up. Bella is a junior, right?
Yes.
Miss Bella Brown Sparks is a junior at Bloomington High School North. And I'm just going to step aside because I think what is important is to hear how kids feel. And so what she has is, and this is not, I don't want to put Bella on the spot, she's speaking for others who cannot be here today. So she's going to share some quotes that students wanted you to hear about their experiences. So I'm going to step aside.
Okay. Senior at Bloomington High School North. I've honestly had a pretty hard time learning math and science. Everything else has been pretty easy to get down. I feel like teachers don't really take as much time with me to make sure I fully understand. We barely have any black teachers here too. Junior at Bloomington High School South. Being a black student in the Monroe County School Corporation, I've had times where my teachers don't take me seriously with my academics. One of my teachers knew how I struggled in the class and didn't inform me of after school tutoring. Junior at Bloomington High School North. Being a black female, getting an education in Bloomington can be really hard because everyone, including teachers, sometimes don't expect much from you. You really have to prove yourself to be accepted by your peers and teachers. I used to have to change my whole demeanor so I didn't come off as a loud, ghetto, stereotypical black girl. Junior at Bloomington High School North. I've often been expected to be unsuccessful. A lot of my teachers didn't expect me to do well in school and didn't encourage me to work as hard as they did for the white kids. Senior at Bloomington High School North. You have to talk to people of color and white people differently. It's a different vibe. When I talk to white people, I have to be neutral about what I say. I try to sway the conversation to go whichever way is better for me. I didn't learn much book information. School taught me how to network and market myself. Senior at Bloomington High School North. Seeing a teacher that looks like you is like seeing a $3 bill. Senior at Bloomington High School South. I watched my brother go through school. I listened to the stories of how his teachers interacted with him and did everything in my power to avoid that. He was targeted, bullied, left in school suspension, and at one point convinced to think as little about his future as the teachers who told him he didn't have one. Sometimes we work twice as hard as everyone else just so we won't be written off. Thank you.
So I just think we should give another round of applause to the young people. Thank you. They could be at home watching TV on a date, you know. So I'm just happy. So I think for me, this quote embodies something. Let us come together as a community and fight the battles that need to be fought today so that the people coming after us will have a benchmark of their bravery, one that they ought to live and grow by. And so I think that when we look at the challenges with black education, that, you know, this is a community. This is not a black issue. This is a community issue, and we have to address it. We cannot continue to let our kids feel the way they feel And also how we use the data. We also have to think about, you know, how are we using standardized tests to determine a kid's future? How are we using that information? Are there other ways that we can look at them? And I think that that's work that I'm hopeful, and I think it's starting to be done. But it's a lot to do, and it starts with every single person in this room. Even before I had a child, I was working on the behalf of children. And I know that, you know, there are younger people, even younger than Caleb, who and Bella, who could get up here and talk too. But I was also surprised that a lot of students didn't want to come here. They wanted to remain anonymous. And I think that says a lot too, that they're afraid to speak up. And that hurts my heart, you know, in 2018, that we have students in the community who go to school every day and they're surviving their education. So thank you. I'm going to turn it back over to William. And also I have to say, we should really give William Hosea a hand, and because he helped spearhead all of this. And I really do appreciate it. Thank you, William. And Rafi Hassan. Thank you.
Yeah. Wait a minute, Stephanie. It's time for question and answer. I'm not sitting on this hot seat by myself. So, again, like I said at the end of my presentation, I hope we have given you something to think about. So we'll go ahead and open it up for questions if you have any. Yes, sir. Absolutely. We just got to figure out where to put it. Yeah, we can make that happen. Okay. Al.
I commend the committee for this group. It's true.
Thank you.
I have one concern. Bloomington is a transient community. We've got many years in the university, in the workforce, in the city.
Yeah. Okay, so you already convinced we're going to have another study, huh? Okay. Well, let me say this. Would you like to see something like this done again?
Yes.
Okay, so my position was I'd be willing to do it again, number one, if the community wanted it. And number two, if we could get some more people to step up and help do the work. Now, Stephanie is a doctor of education in the education system. Jeff Bradley is a practicing attorney. Me, I needed a tutor for college math. You know, so we could really use the help if we want to go out and collect more data, because there is all kinds of data to be collected, but I don't want to saturate you with it, you know? We only want to pick out the pertinent data that you really want to hear. And so to do that, we're going to need to hear from you. Bev?
People want to volunteer, they can put it on their evaluation sheet, they want their thank you.
Okay. Sue?
I was just going to volunteer, that's all.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Daniel? Data of number of black
And I think one of the things that would probably be helpful with the future data collection is to dive a little bit more in depth about the information. And I think their hope is going to look at the population numbers and give you more data to work with. Because I think the challenge is whenever we look at a snapshot, it's not going to give a great fair reflection. But I think the hope and goal of everybody in this type of program is that if we're dealing with a jail situation, that you want your pretrial stay to be limited as much as possible and not rely heavily on a system that would unnecessarily incarcerate individuals. Sure.
That number is
very right. Sure. And I think that's going to be some of the other aspects, and also probably how you volunteered yourself for helping out in some future aspects. But that's what we were saying. When you look at their study, it's about the first study was a 61-page study, and it covered a lot of information and data. So I don't think the snapshot is going to give you the perfect amount, but I appreciate your point of analysis, because I think that's something that people are interested as well into, is even with the numbers being low, how does it reflect to our populations, and how many people are incarcerated based on our population. So I think that'll be something that's going to be encouraged to be expanded upon next year, or maybe farther than next year. I don't know when. I'll leave that to William.
I didn't hear what you said.
Just mind the back.
Okay. If the questioner is comfortable with that, you know, yeah. So what I'll do is repeat the questions. In fact, I'll repeat what you just said. Clarence wanted to know if anyone asking a question would be willing to come to the microphone so we can have it recorded. So we can fix that. I'll just repeat the question.
So he asked me about the two or more classification, which is fairly new, and that's the challenge. Like, we don't know, and I don't know if that data can be disaggregated. I'm sure it could be, but I don't know if when people mark that box that they have to do that, right? And so we just know that they are two or more. And that actually could skew numbers dramatically, right? How that data plays out, it's, you know, but people get to identify the way they want to. Well, maybe, I'll take that back. In one of the following boxes, how about that? So that is hard, but you will see similar trends, right, across the board with the two or more and black. And then in some areas, they excel higher, though. But yeah, sorry. And if anybody knows about that, that would be great. Yes, up there, yes.
What do you believe is the reasoning for the disproportionate use of the out-of-school suspension in comparison to the other forms of discipline?
He asked me, what are my beliefs? Now, these are really hard questions, you all. What is the belief about in-school suspension?
The out-of-school suspension.
Repeat your question again.
What do you believe is the cause of out-of-school suspension being so much higher than, say, expulsion or in-school suspension?
Okay. Why is out-of-school suspension higher than expulsion or in-school suspension? And, you know, and so for me, I think schools, we really do need to do a study. We need to figure out what's going on, because actually that data could be broken down at building level. So you can go in and look and see at North, how's this working? At South, at University Elementary, at Fairview. You could actually do that. And at the school level, although, you know, this is quite controversial, a different level of accountability, you can actually look and see who's doing the referrals. And there's a lot of notion about restorative justice. There are different ways to approach discipline in schools, right? And so it's really up to us talking to and developing relationships and getting involved at the school district level. I do believe they're in a, they're trying to figure it out too. I think they're looking at the data and they're aware of what's going on, hence you see some of the different things that they're trying to do at the school district level. And I know all these things are really complex and nuanced and they're relational and people get uncomfortable, but the truth is our kids are suffering. So we can't, fragility and, I think we just have to be prepared to ask tough questions and work together, work through it, which is not easy. Yes?
In looking at the out-of-school suspension data, it's directly connected to the school because of pipeline.
It is.
Because it's kids who are unsupervised out of school that are getting into trouble, where if they were in school, they wouldn't have the same opportunity.
Exactly. And so all of it is very connected, and that's why Caleb so eloquently was sharing that information, and we thought it was interesting. And I have to say, you know, I always tell people that we've gotten to a point where people are making money off of black failure. And I'm gonna put black failure, failure of students of color. You know, there are corporations that are creating tests. And I mean, so we need to figure this out because it's really impacting our kids that, you know, we want failure because it's making us money. And so that's a different approach and way to think about it, but how sad is that? And so we really have to step back and think about, you know, what's happening? And we really have to get involved and ask those tough questions. I research black education, and I look at young women of color, and some of my research, I believe that whatever I do should have an on-the-ground component. So you'll see me in schools doing projects like reading and different things. And it's really hard, but we just need more people on the ground and involved. I saw your hand, Dr. McCluskey. She is asking me, Dr. McCluskey, asked me about what kind of impact has some of the programs that I have done in the community had. Years ago, I had a program called CLIP. And this program, I haven't done it. I had a cohort of students, and basically I followed them from middle school to high school until they graduated. So it was a longitudinal study. So the idea was that, I'm gonna call it a cultural gap, that schools couldn't do everything, but we had to have spaces in our community for kids to grow. And so they got tutored with Hudson and Holland Scholars, and they came to campus. We met at various places in the community twice a week. And they got tutored. I think it was Tuesdays and Thursdays they came, and the last time we met on campus. And then we met for an hour to do these cultural enrichments. So they had studies, they did studies, and they presented research, and we talked about what research was and inquiry. I can recall two of those students, nobody in their family had graduated from high school. They went to college. All of those kids are doing great now. The overwhelming majority of them went on to at least definitely graduated from high school, went to college. So I know that culture, having that space to talk, having that space to debrief and learn about who you are and expectations, and having that was very supportive. And I keep in touch with some of them still to this day. The read-in, you know, when I get feedback from the African-American read-in, same thing. Sisters Who Care, same thing. And I think it's time consuming. It doesn't fit in my schedule. It's crazy. Like right now at North, they're doing Black History Month, and they have a series of events. And Don Griffin was there today. We had someone from the Black Caucus. They Skyped in and talked to the kids. But that's all just extra stuff that I have to make work, because it's more than just writing articles about it. I need to make sure that I'm taking care of people on the ground as I'm doing that work. So I think, and I think, just think, if everybody in here decided to do something, that level of impact, that ripple, because it's really not about me. I learn every day. I love being around young people because they teach me so much. I am so ignorant about a lot of things. So I really love doing that work, but they, you know, so they're my great, they're great teachers and supporters. I saw another hand, and I don't, yes.
So I think we received a lot of information tonight. So what are some solution-based responses we can have, or for those who aren't necessarily able to get on board with the research component, like we have students who are in here that may not want to miss, or we can have our, what are recommendations that you can give to be active starting tomorrow or next week, so it's not that we're waiting for another study to release your phone?
You want to take that?
Okay,
one way that you can get involved is, which actually flows right to Donald Griffin's suggestion about 60 seconds ago, we have a Bloomington Black Strategic Alliance. It is an alliance of organizations. We meet once a quarter and consist of people who are active in the community, different groups, and what we do is we come together and we share information about what each organization is doing. We coordinate our activities, and then all of us, of course, are recruiting people to join their respective organizations. So if you really want to get involved, that's like the hub of activity in the community, in the Black community right there.
And it's fairly new. We just kind of started this. And the idea was that we need to unify and we need to come together and figure out how to tackle some of these things. We need more elected officials. We need more presence. But, you know, how do you do that if you don't come together and talk about your challenges? And so that was just one way. And I think anybody who's a part of the BB, the Bloomington Black Strategic Alliance, stand up if you're here. Stand up. Go ahead, Beverly. Stand up. Aren't you a part of it? You're not a part of it? Oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. And so basically, it's just representation of different organizations. And so even City of Bloomington, you know, we connect with them and let them know different events and different things that are going on. So, okay. Yes. Definitely. Definitely.
Okay, Beverly Callender is giving me that look. So we have time for one more question. Sue, you've had your hand up for a while now.
It was just so quick about the data. Are we allowed to look at the referrals to CPS for the school?
So there's some confidentiality always involved. As an educator, I have to tell you that. And so you can access the data online, but I think, I'm sorry, what? No, I mean I'm saying general data, right? But you can, and you can look at schools' report cards and different things, but we never want to put, you know, student information out. We always want to protect them, so.
Okay. I want to thank you all again for coming out. That's about all we have time for, and maybe we'll see you again next year.
Thank you.